Can you believe these lessons? I can't decide if they are the most inappropriate readings imaginable for the Sunday after an election or a pairing of sheer genius. The lectionary, our three-year cycle of readings, is like that sometimes. We are moving towards Advent, the season of preparation for Christmas. And these last couple of Sundays before Advent always pick up on that season's theme of endings. For the life of Jesus to begin at Christmas and for his second coming to appear in God's good time, something has to end. We always hear about the world passing away at this time of year. It's important to acknowledge two things here. First, we at St. Bede's are not of one mind on anything, much less on politics. We value differing opinions in this community, and that's one of our strengths as a parish. Our diversity of belief is not always comfortable or easy. We make mistakes and we say or do hurtful things from time to time, but we are able to come together around this table in spite of our differences. And second, there are members of our community who are hurting over the election of Donald Trump as president. It's not everyone, for sure, but I've spoken with a number of you who feel as though the world is passing away. At its core, this feeling is not about one candidate losing, but about a dream that America's bedrock promise of liberty and justice for all really meant liberty and justice for all. Something sacred and precious died on Tuesday night. I've seen the signs of grieving, shock, numbness, tears that won't stop coming. Part of gathering around this table as one diverse community involves bearing one another's pain, even if we are not experiencing it ourselves. When one member of the body of Christ suffers, all the members suffer with it. So regardless of our own reaction to the election, we sorrow with those who are in pain. The Jesus we encounter in Luke's gospel today seems to be predicting a coming catastrophe. The glorious, gorgeous temple in Jerusalem, the house of God adorned with gold and the finest human hands can produce, will be thrown down. Not fallen, but thrown down, deliberately, violently. Wars, insurrections, nation rising against nation, earthquakes, famines, plagues. It sounds like a vision of a terrifying future. In fact, Luke is not predicting the future, but describing the past. This catastrophe had already happened. The insurrection, the Jewish revolt of the year 68, had evolved into all-out war with the Roman Empire. By the year 73, the temple had been thrown down, its treasures carried off to Rome. Thousands of Jews were dead. Many more had their lives disrupted. Luke wrote down his gospel between 10 and 20 years later, when the lingering effects of the catastrophe were still felt. But the event itself was in the past. The worst thing that could happen to the Jewish people had already happened. And not only had it had already happened more than once. The temple destroyed in the Jewish revolt was the second temple on that site in Jerusalem. The first one, the temple built by Solomon, had been thrown down 600 years earlier when the Babylonian Empire conquered Israel. It was an even worse time for Israel than the revolt against Rome. Babylon killed the Jewish king, sacked Jerusalem, and carried most of the people into exile. Everything that made Israel Israel was gone. The temple, the dwelling house of God, the royal line descended from King David, the land given to their ancestors, all of it was lost. It was the greatest catastrophe that Israel had ever experienced. But what Israel found in those years of exile was that this was not the end. It was an end, but it was not the end of their people. It was not the end of their God. God was still there, still active and working in their lives. Grief for all they had lost choked them at first. Yet as time passed, they found that God had not abandoned them. Life in exile was painful and difficult. Israel had to reinvent itself, reimagine who it was apart from the temple, the land, the king. But at the end of every day, they were still God's people, and God was still their God. That would never change. It could never change. That collective memory of the last time the worst happened lived on into Luke's time. He knew, and his audience knew, that the Jewish revolt was an end, but not the end. They were still God's people, and God was still their God. God was still active and working in their lives. What's more, catastrophes present opportunities. The Jewish revolt brought persecution and personal danger to the people. They were arrested, jailed, presented before kings and governors for judgment. Luke saw these persecutions as opportunities to bear witness to Jesus Christ. They put you on trial, then testify to the love of God made flesh in Jesus Christ. Don't worry about what to say. God is with you, and Emmanuel, God with us, will give you the words to say. And by standing firm, you will win for yourselves life, true life, life in all its fullness. Luke is pointing here towards the third way of Jesus. Human beings have two basic responses to threat, fight or flight. These are instincts. They're hardwired in us. They reside in the most primitive parts of our brains, our lizard brains, as they're sometimes called. Jesus taught that fight or flight are not our only two options. There's a third way, staying engaged without returning violence for violence. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, treating you like a slave, you can hit back, you can run away, or you can turn the other cheek and force him to treat you as an equal. If a Roman soldier demands that you carry his pack for 1 mile, as is legally allowed, carry it for 2 miles, which is not legal and will get him in trouble. If someone asks you for your coat and demands to shame you, give him your shirt too, because being in the presence of a naked person will shame him. The third way is rooted in love of neighbor, in love of the enemy, and ultimately in the love that gave its life so that we might live. The third way is love in action. Staying engaged without returning violence for violence does not come easily to us. We have to overcome millions of years of instinct to bypass our lizard brains. This kind of love requires the wisdom of serpents and the gentleness of doves. But we can learn through the grace of God and patience and practice and the words that Emmanuel, God with us, will give. We can learn how to do it. Stephen Colbert observed at the end of his election coverage that we used to pay attention to politics only every 4 years, or maybe every 2 if we were into it. Now we pay attention all the time, not to being informed citizens, but to the horse race of politics. And he said that we have been drinking poison. We took a sip, we liked how it tasted, we liked how it made us feel, and we have drunk deeply of poison. I think he's right. And I think we see the effects of that poison in the toxic divisions in our society. A Pew poll found that 4 in 10 Democrats and 4 in 10 Republicans thought the other party's policies are so misguided they pose a threat to the nation. 55% of Democrats and 49% of Republicans said the policies of the other party made them afraid. We cannot go on like this. We have got to put down the poison and drink instead the soothing, healing, strengthening cup of love. We need to take that love into ourselves. We need to let it become our bodies until we are breathing and bleeding and crying love. We need to be the love our broken country so desperately needs. When I think about what this might look like, I think of what happened at a football game in Boston last weekend. A Muslim couple were in the stands, and when it came time for them to pray, they left their seats to find a quiet corner. They're always nervous about praying in public because they're afraid they'll be attacked while their attention is focused on God. As they began to pray, a stadium security officer approached them. The wife thought, "Here comes this guy. He's going to tell me we can't do this here and escort us out." Instead, the officer said, "I'm going to stand here and guard you guys to make sure no one gives you any problems. Go ahead and pray. When the couple finished their prayers, he shook their hands and told them to enjoy the game. That is what our actions look like when we drink love. I don't know if protecting this couple was the security officer's first instinct. Maybe his impulse was to walk away, and he had to remind himself consciously that he had another choice. It may not have been his natural reaction, but he chose to be love. He didn't fight anyone, he didn't run away, he chose to love. Can we do that? Can we drink of love, savor it, roll it around our tongues, take it in and let it become us until our lizard instinct is changed to love? Our country needs us to love and our neighbors need us to love. Harassment of black and brown people, Muslims, Jews, LGBTQ people, and women has been rising the last few months, and it's accelerated since Wednesday morning. The same thing happened in Britain after the Brexit vote. Violent and prejudiced campaign rhetoric emboldened the worst elements of human nature. We might believe Silicon Valley is too diverse and tolerant for this to happen here, but it does happen here. A columnist for the New York Times reported last month about a Latino woman shopping at Drager's in Menlo Park who was told by another customer, "You should go to Safeway. This store is for white people." No one chose to love this neighbor of ours the way the security guard stood up for the Muslim couple. But we can. We can, and we must. There are bowls of safety pins on the tables at the back of the church. After Brexit, British people of goodwill began wearing safety pins in solidarity with immigrants experiencing harassment. The safety pin says, "I commit to confronting harassment whenever I see it. I stand with you, and I choose to love you, even if it costs me something." Wearing a safety pin is spreading in America now. It is a small gesture of solidarity. It is a visible sign that we will stay engaged without returning violence for violence. I've been wearing a safety pin since Friday, and I realized I have to be prepared to follow through on this commitment of support, even if it puts me at risk. It's frightening, yet I feel a sense of peace about it too. I choose the third way of Jesus. I choose to be love in a world that needs love so very badly. We people of God have survived the worst, not once, but several times. We will survive whatever comes now, too. Whatever happens, we are God's people, and God is our God. God is with us, working in us, and with us, and through us, as our love in action heals this broken world.